Okay, so yeah, as Vidanya said, we're moving on from the White Lotus Sutra, which we've had a few weeks on previously, to the Bodhicaryavatara. So the way I'm going to start this talk is by kind of bringing it into context, in that there's two great movements, two great even shifts in one's being when one practices the spiritual life, right from the time when you first have those small inclinations that maybe you want to change, maybe going to the Buddhist center would be a good idea. Maybe there's another way of life that would be a bit richer, maybe a bit calmer than your own. Right up until enlightenment itself, there's these two great shifts in one's being. And in fact, the whole of the Buddhist path is about these shifts in one's being. And the shifts in one's being are firstly a movement away from, and secondly a movement towards. So the movement away from is traditionally called going forth. In order to practice the spiritual life, one has to leave behind one's old habits, and leave behind looking for satisfaction in things that can't give you satisfaction. In a way, one has to become unworldly, has to have some sort of dissatisfaction with life as it is ordinarily lived. And this is the predominant message of the Pali Canon, which we looked at firstly in these series on Buddhist texts. The Pali Canon, where the Buddha says, "Let the follower give up the desire for sense pleasure. Let the follower refrain from gossip and give up anger and greed, attraction and repulsion. Not seeing any value in material belongings, removing strong desire for grasping objects, being one who is unattached and who is not led by others, he would properly lead a homeless life." So the Buddha again and again in the Pali Canon asks us to go forth, leave behind those old habits, leave behind things that cannot make you happy, and instead go for refuge to what is beautiful, what is real, what is about liberation and about peace, what is about enlightenment. And this is the second great movement in one's spiritual life, the movements towards what is beautiful, what is possible, the goal of the spiritual life. And in order for one to leave behind old habits, one has to move towards something else. One movement entails the other. You can't have renunciation without going for refuge. You can't have going for refuge without renunciation or without going forth. And the thing about the Mahayana, which makes it so wonderful and so rich as part of the Buddhist tradition, is that the Mahayana emphasizes what you go for refuge to. It emphasizes the goal of the spiritual life in the most glowing, beautiful and rich terms. It draws out and holds up in front of you in all its shining and effervescent glory the great goal of the spiritual life. It holds up a vision of the immeasurable wisdom, the immeasurable compassion, the immeasurable energy that we as human beings can attain, even in this lifetime. And it holds it out in front of you and it says, yes, this is what life is about. This is what enlightenment was about. This is what the path of the spiritual practitioner is about. And in a way, that's what the texts of the Mahayana are about. They're bursting with this kind of cosmic vision. Maybe it goes a little bit over the top sometime, but I say so much the better. Let's go a little bit over the top. It's a blip. I was going to swear then, but that was going over the top. I was doing so well until that point. You know, it's a brilliant thing that we're doing. We're doing this most amazing, incredible thing. You know, there's so much greed and hatred and delusion in the world. And we're putting a stop to it. We're saying, no, I'm not going to live my life by greed, hatred and delusion. I'm going to live my life by ethics and love and wisdom. I'm going to do something of immense benefit to the whole world, to the whole universe, to the whole cosmos throughout space and time. And I think that's pretty good, actually. So this is what the Mahayana vision says to me. It says, you know, this is what we're heading towards. And when you really see the goal of the spiritual life, if you really see what we can become as human beings, then everything else is just a shadow, a pale shadow, insignificant, doesn't matter at all. So the great goal of the Mahayana vision of the spiritual life is the bodhicitta. And this is what the Mahayana holds up to us and says, this is what we can aspire towards. This is what we can take part in, and this is what we can become. So what is the bodhicitta? Well, bodhi, as you may know, means enlightenment, or is sometimes called awakening. Although I always think that sounds a little odd, but never mind, I'm going to go with enlightenment. And citta, which is quite difficult to translate, but it means something along the lines of a combination of will of heart and mind. So Sangharakshita calls the bodhicitta the will to enlightenment. It's when your whole heart, your whole mind, your whole volition, your whole being, in fact, is focused not just on your own enlightenment, but on the enlightenment of all beings. It's a very sublime, mysterious, all-encompassing goal of the spiritual life. It's as if you are swept up in a great fire, in a great flood of energy, which is always pouring in the direction towards universal liberation. That's what the bodhicitta is, and you're just caught up in this fire that's always going towards the direction of the enlightenment, not just for one person, but for all beings. Universal liberation, universal enlightenment. And when you get caught up in that flood, you become a bodhisattva, a being of enlightenment, which means that you are someone who's caught up in this universal liberation, and that you strive to actualize for the benefit of all the highest potentialities that the universe contains. That's a quote from Sangharakshita. But in a way, well, it just shows what we're dealing with. What we're dealing with is the highest potentialities that the universe contains. That's what a bodhisattva is. It's caught up in that direction. And being caught up in that direction. And to what is highest. Your whole being devoted to what is highest in this universe. So Sangharakshita also explains it in a very good early lecture he gave, which is in the Bodhisattva Ideal series. He gave a lecture about the bodhicitta called The Awakening of the Bodhi Heart, which I think is a very beautiful way of describing it, the awakening of the Bodhi Heart. And it's the kind of state that you get into, which, as Shantideva says, he says, you make this kind of vow: as long as space abides and as long as the world abides, so long may I abide, destroying the sufferings in the world. So it's this kind of cosmic vision that's beyond the self, that's beyond one human being, but dealing with a much bigger vision of reality, the vision of reality that all beings can gain enlightenment, and that you want to be part of that movement of all beings. So the text that we're going to deal with in the next, I think it's actually, maybe it's 6, maybe it's 7, I can't remember. I partly can't remember because I missed out a date. I don't know if anyone noticed this on the board, but I actually missed out a date. Anyway, so I think it might be 7 weeks on the Bodhicaryavatara, not 6. But this is the text we're going to look at. And the text we're going to look at is concerned with the bodhicitta as the goal of the spiritual life and the way leading to the bodhicitta, to realization of the bodhicitta. So I'll give you a bit of background about this text. It was written by Shantideva, who was a monk at the great monastic university, Nalanda, around the year 800, you know, that century, whatever it is, the 9th century. And I'll tell you a bit of a legend about Shantideva, partly because it's a good story. It may not be true, but it's a good story anyway. So the legend is that Shantideva was known as eats, shits and sleeps, because basically that's all he did. As far as the monks in the monastery were concerned, all Shantideva did was eat, shit and sleep. They thought he was pretty lazy. And so as a big joke, just to show him up, the monks asked him to recite some scriptures from memory, to recite some of the Buddhist scriptures from memory. So you've got to imagine this monastic university, we're talking about thousands of monks, not hundreds, but thousands. And so the story goes, they gathered all these monks to listen to Shantideva, I mean basically to show him up, listen to Shantideva recite the Buddhist scriptures, which they were all convinced he wouldn't know any of them because all he did was eat shit and sleep. And so if you ever think that you've had a public speaking nightmare, that's got to be worse than anything that you've done, quite frankly. Anyway, so as part of this game, the story goes that they set up this giant teaching seat, but they set it up so it was just a little bit too high for him to get on, which I think is, I don't think they could have been doing much of the Metta Bhavana myself, but, you know. So they set up this great big sort of platform thing for him to speak on. And as he got there, they were all sort of waiting. You can imagine them just waiting for him to sort of trip up and have this whole nightmare of how to get on this platform. But, you know, Shantideva was no ordinary monk. So the story goes that he just touched the platform with his hand and just brought it down magically with the force of his, I don't know, bodhicitta or something. So down came the seat and he got on it. So they should have known they were in trouble now, the monks, that something a little bit odd was going to happen. But I don't think they learnt the lesson that quickly, because the next thing is they say, the Shantideva said, shall I recite something old or something new? And they said, no, recite something new. And then out came the Bodhicharyavatara. And he was so inspired, Shantideva, that he actually, so the story goes, raised into the sky halfway through reciting the Bodhicharyavatara and disappeared from view, although his voice could still be heard. And then after the Bodhicharyavatara, he'd sort of recited the Bodhicharyavatara, he disappeared entirely. There is a bit of a story about that as well, because you never hear a story about Shantideva again after the Bodhicharyavatara, if you take that kind of story as mainly true. But then what happens is there is a story about someone called Eats, Shits and Sleeps, who travels around all the very poor villages around northern India and sleeping in caves and just giving teachings. So some of the stories say that maybe that was him. I quite like to think it was him. I quite like to think he said, well, you know, I'm wasting my time with these guys. I think the villages is where it's at. It's a bit like saying, you know, you're at some really good Buddhist centre, I don't know, like Padmaloka, and then you think, nah, where it's at is Sheffield. I'm just going to sleep in the gallery in the freezing cold. And I'm just going to give teachings to the people of Sheffield because they're much more worthy. Sorry, Pamalaja. I'm sure it's great, Pamalaka. So, yeah, okay. Well, you may not believe this. That's okay. I don't mind. But it does demonstrate a point that's often made in Buddhist scriptures. And the point that's often made in Buddhist scriptures is that it's the transformation of one's mind, the transformation of one's heart, the transformation of one's fundamental attitude that is important, not gaining a successful spiritual career. You know, Shantideva wasn't popular. He didn't have a big status in the monastery. He wasn't a big teacher. He wasn't a big lecturer. He didn't have a lot of a kind of renown or praise. But while everyone else is asleep, so it is said, when the monastery was at its quietest, at its most still, there would be Shantideva spending all night in meditation, all night receiving teachings from a higher plane, from Manjushri himself, when everybody else was asleep. And in a way, well, that's why he was called Eats, Shits and Sleep, because that was all they saw. What they didn't see was all the work he was doing on himself in the middle of the night. So I think that's going to be my excuse of why I'm so moody in the mornings, because actually what I'm doing is spending all night in meditation. No, I'm not actually. So the main point is that that Shantideva, he wasn't properly, he wasn't about gaining a spiritual career. What he was about was really practicing the spiritual life, really transforming his heart, transforming his mind. So whatever, whether that story is true or not, what is for sure about the Bodhicaryavatara is its influence on the rest of Buddhist history. It is an incredibly influential book. It was called part of the golden age of Mahayana Buddhism in India. But even since then, it's influenced a lot of modern Buddhist teachers, the Dalai Lama included. So apparently it's the Dalai Lama's favourite text. And even in the Sheffield Buddhist Centre, there was, you may not know this, but there was quite a kind of battle to do this talk. Quite a lot of people want to do talks about the Bodhicaryavatara. In fact, I think I just got on this platform this evening by a force of will or something. But yeah, could have been a schism in the order, but it wasn't. So yeah, so people love the Bodhicaryavatara. If you talk about the Bodhicaryavatara, all these order members will go, oh yeah, well, and they'll start quoting, you know, verses. They'll start saying how many translations they've got. I have to say, I'm a bit poor show on this because I've only got one translation, but there we go. So people love it, and you probably know bits of it, actually, without knowing that you know bits of it. You'll probably recognise some quotes. And I think people love it so much, both because it's very poetical and because it somehow expresses in the most beautiful way people's noblest spiritual ideals. There's something about it that really expresses what our spiritual life is about, what our ideals are about. But it's also interesting that I always find it fascinating that Bodhicaryavatara is so popular. I mean, as a Buddhist text, it's so popular. Because it really is very challenging. And it's not written, it's not couched in comfortable language. You know, the Bodhicaryavatara at no point is going to say, well, you know, just accept yourself the way you are. You know, just get into your body or whatever. There's something Sangharakshita went to a Buddhist conference and he came back and apparently he said, oh well, yes, there seems to be a new type of Buddhism. It's called candy floss Buddhism. He said there's a lot of it, it's very sweet, but there's not much to it. And I think there is a lot of modern Buddhism which is very nice, it's very sweet, but there's not really much to it. And I find I read those books and I think, oh yeah, that's really great. And then I just completely forget about them. But you're in no danger of forgetting the Bodhicaryavatara. You're in no danger of forgetting the Bodhicaryavatara when it says to you, hey you, expecting results without effort, so sensitive, so long-suffering. You, in the clutches of death, acting like an immortal. Hey sufferer, you are destroying yourself. Now that you have met with a boat of human life, cross over the mighty river of suffering. Fool! There is no time to sleep. It is hard to catch this boat again. So I wonder how that would go at a beginner's course. Sort of week one. You fool! In the clutches of death, acting like an immortal. It's very like that. I mean, it has sort of verses of great evocations of natural beauty, and then a lot of them where it talks about, you know, really getting to the heart of matter, really giving you a good poke. And I think actually that's what we want. I think deep down, if you're really into the spiritual life, you don't want everyone to be nice and tell you that you're doing fine all the time. What you want is someone to go, wake up! You know, here you are, what are you waiting for? Now is the time to practice the spiritual life. What are you wasting your time on? And I think that Bodhicaryavatara does that very, very well. And in this kind of very, you know, straight on down the line language, manages to really reach something that we know that life is about. I mean, above all else, you kind of know that Shantideva is right. And I think it's good to know when someone's right, even if you don't like what they're saying very much. So the Bodhicaryavatara is a hugely influential text and a great treatise on the bodhicitta. It starts off with a praise of the bodhicitta, and then talks about how you train in it. And a kind of loose structure for the rest of the text is it kind of evocation of the bodhicitta, keeping the bodhicitta in mind, remembering the qualities of bodhicitta, being aware of the bodhicitta, being aware of your practice, and practicing the six perfections. So the other talks in this series will be to do with the six perfections, which are classical list of the spiritual path. The spiritual path is sometimes looked at as practicing the six perfections, which are generosity, ethics, patience, vigour or energy in pursuit of the good, as it's sometimes called, meditation and wisdom. So that's what we'll be looking at in the rest of the series on the Bodhicharya Vatara. We'll have some talks by Kemasuri, and he's doing a talk on this, yeah. And Suryamata is going to do a talk, and I think I am as well. So I won't go into all those areas, but what I will do is talk about the beginning, the opening part of the Bodhicharya Vatara, where it talks about in praise of the bodhicitta. So I think it's very, very significant that it starts off with praise and awe. Because to do anything in life, we need to be motivated. We need to really long for what we aim to do. If we're not motivated, we just won't do it. And very often, that's the problem. We're not motivated because we kind of don't see the benefits. And we muster up a bit of enthusiasm for a while, but it drifts. I remember going on a really brilliant training event for Evolution Shop about timelines. And when I was there, I was thinking, yeah, we're going to put up this massive timeline and it's going to organise, it's going to revolutionise my life, and I'm going to put little lines on it, I'm going to get coloured felt-tip pens, and I'm going to write all these things, and I'm going to be completely organised for the rest of my life. So while I was in Cambridge, I was really going to gung-ho, get some graph paper and some felt-tips and a ruler, and, let's get there. And then I got to Evolution on Monday, and I just thought, no, I can't bother. Because actually I just thought, well, I managed to do it all right, I've got this little £1 diary and sometimes I write things and there's a whiteboard and, well, we haven't got felt tips, but, we kind of got a pencil and we don't have a ruler, but we've got the edge of a book and you can kind of draw straight lines. So it was a bit like I just didn't really see the benefits. And I think that's what we do a lot. We just don't really, we don't do things because we don't really want to, actually. We don't really see the benefits. We're not that inspired by it. And we definitely don't long for it. So if that's true in the ordinary sense, if it's true of ordinary life, it's so much more true about the spiritual life. The spiritual life is hard. It takes a lot of effort. It takes a lot of effort to meditate first thing in the morning. It takes a lot of effort to decide not to watch that DVD, but to do a puja instead. It's not easy. To do the spiritual life, to really enter into it, it's almost like you have to be slightly in love with it. You have to really long for it. You have to really see the benefits. It's got to capture your heart. I remember a good friend of mine who had, for years and years, she had trouble getting up for meditation first thing in the morning. And then she fell in love with someone in America. And then all of a sudden, she was getting up 2 hours early every morning to phone him on Skype or whatever. For 2 hours a day every morning. And she said, I realised then I wasn't really motivated to meditate in the morning. And I thought to myself, well, that's what we need. We need to be really in love with the Dharma. If we were in love with the Dharma, if we were in love with Buddhist practice, nothing would stop us. But I think our problem is we kind of drag our feet slightly because, you just think, DVD, puja. Just watch the DVD. So that's what we need. We need to cultivate a real interest, a real passion for the spiritual life. And this is what Shantideva does. He evokes the bodhicitta. He really goes into it. He contemplates it. He uses poetry and similes to really explore the bodhicitta, so that you want to develop it, so that you really want a taste of this for yourself. And I think it's also significant that he starts with praise of the bodhicitta, because he's not talking about the Bodhicitta as some sort of doctrine, you know, some sort of intellectual treatise where, you know, an academic is kind of going,
well, the Mahayana movement started about 500 years after the Buddha died. And it's called the Bodhicitta, which in Sanskrit means Bodhi, awakening or enlightenment, and Citta, heart, mind. You know, I mean, if it's like that, well, we're already asleep. Quite frankly, you know, you could just go and read a book and you probably get really bored with that as well. So Sangha actually says, well, you know, the Bodhicitta is more like a myth. It's much more all-encompassing than just some sort of doctrine, just something that someone pulled out of the sky just to, you know, just to, as a kind of Sanskrit puzzle in which to reflect on it. You know, the Bodhicitta is more like a myth. It's something that we can give all our energies to. It's something that we can really aspire to become. It's a great vision, actually. Not just some part of Buddhist history, but a great vision coming out of an experience of the potential for humanity. So the first bit of the Bodhicaryavatara is a contemplation of this myth, an evocation of this myth, even a kind of longing praise, a prayer, a hymn to the Bodhicitta, in order to inspire us to really want to achieve it for ourselves. And Padma Vajra gave me this book a while back called Vast as the Heavens, Deep as the Sea, which I really love, actually. And it's got 356 verses in praise of the Bodhicitta. It's basically taken this idea of Shantideva and it's just gone for it big style. Yeah, so it was written in 1959 by a Tibetan in exile. And what was interesting is that over the Christmas and New Year, Ginny and I were together and we were doing quite a lot of meditation. We tried to just read as much of this as we could every day. You know, not try and understand it or think about it or, you know, write any notes on it or anything like that. We didn't even talk about it. We just decided to read it and see what effect it had on us. And I have to say, being with Ginny meditating, you know, we could probably read the telephone directory and still find it really inspiring. But we didn't. We wrote this, read this out loud to each other. And it was incredible effect, actually, because after a while what I noticed is, yeah, I really wanted to attain the Bodhicitta. I really wanted that. I was really enthused by it. I was really inspired. And no matter how tired I was, and even if I didn't really understand what he was on about, you know, because some of it's quite Tibetan and they use categories that I'm not familiar with. But even if I didn't really understand it, I found myself deeply moved. I found myself deeply moved at what we could become, you know, what Ginny and I could do with our practice. So just as an exercise, I think it's a really good thing to do. A kind of meditation on the Bodhicitta. So the praise is a meditation on the Bodhicitta, a contemplation of the Bodhicitta, but it also gives us a glimpse into what this mysterious thing called the Bodhicitta really is and what it would like to be a part of it. So what I'm going to do is just draw out a few themes. There's quite a lot in there and I couldn't pick out every little thing he says about the Bodhicitta in this talk, she says, looking at her watch. But I'd just like to say a few things, just to maybe give a flavour of what the Bodhicitta is. Because you could give loads of kind of talks on, you know, well, it's this and that. But in a way, you don't really get a feel for it. The Bodhicitta is a little bit more elusive than that. So maybe we'll just, you know, just by hearing some of the verses of the Bodhicitta, from the Bodhicaryavatara, we'll get an idea of what the Bodhicitta is. So the first thing is the Bodhicitta is about love. The Bodhicitta, as Shantideva says, is a persistent effort for the complete happiness of every being, a seed of pure happiness in the world. And the person in whom it is arisen is called an unequalled friend, who offers to a limitless number of beings throughout limitless time the fulfillment of all desires, unending until the end of the sky. So this is the first important characteristic. that the bodhicitta is a deep desire for the well-being and happiness of others, primarily for the spiritual liberation of others. But also, Shantideva points out, for worldly happiness meanwhile, which I quite like, because when I put you all in the Metta-bhavana, there's part of me that doesn't want, you know, I really want everyone here to be enlightened, otherwise I wouldn't bother doing these talks or working here. But at the same time, you know, I want you all to be happy on a worldly level meanwhile. There's nothing wrong with that. I just want beings to be happy. But the full expression of happiness for me is actually enlightenment itself. Because if you were all enlightened, it wouldn't matter what happened to you, you'd be okay. So that's what I really want for everybody here. But meanwhile, it would be good, you know, to get that job and to have enough food and have nice clothes and whatever it is you wanted. So the bodhicitta is about love, both ordinary love, but also about something far greater, a far greater vision of the potential of human beings, and really wanting people to achieve that potential. In the Vimalakirti Nadesha, the bodhicitta is talked about as Maha Maitri, the great love, the love that yearns for the liberation of all beings. And what a love that is. You know, I think it's important because we can have quite a limited conception of love. You know, we identify it with something so small. Sometimes we even identify it with, you know, I like chocolate or something. Well, I like you. I don't like you. You know, I like you because you kind of wear clothes that I like or something. And actually, the great love is so much more than that. I think it would be worth just taking time to imagine what that kind of the love of the bodhicitta that yearns for the liberation of all, what that love is really like. You know, that love is a power, that love is a force. And it's really important that, you know, the bodhicitta is, it's sometimes called the altruistic dimension of going for refuge, the altruistic dimension of the spiritual life. That's how Sangharakshita describes it. That's what it primarily is. It's primarily about the liberation of others. You know, that the goal, and it's important because the goal of the spiritual life in this sense is other regarding. And it's also important because I think this makes it very attractive. I think that's what we want out of life. I think love is what really motivates us. Love is what really excites us. Love is what we want to develop in this world. Even more so than wisdom, I think love is a really what we want to do with our lives. You know, when we die, we don't want people to necessarily say, well, she was really intelligent or she was really wise. What I want people to say about me, anyway, is that she was really kind. She was really encouraging. That's what I want people to say about me when I die. Not that I was really wise or I said the right thing or I really understood the Buddhist teachings, but that I really was kind and I was really encouraging. And I think that's what we all want. That's what we really hold up as an ideal. We want to be full of love. And the bodhicitta is full of love. Love that has no boundary because there is no distinction between self and other in the bodhicitta. And I think it's significant that the goal of the spiritual life in the Mahayana is altruistic because it's so easy to get trapped in Buddhism, in my meditation, my experience, my attainment, my insight. You know, it can, it's always a criticism that was raised, and I think it's always something we've got to watch that, you know, well, is Buddhism just a bit navel-gazing? Are we just doing it so that we have a nice experience in meditation? Well, it's interesting because we've just been on this weekend retreat. And actually, I say that what's much more important than what experiences people had in meditation is how often they helped with the washing up, how many plates they took of someone else's to get washed up, you know, how many times they make someone else a cup of tea. That's what I think that's really important. And I think we get far too hung up, you know, in what experiences I've had in meditation and whether I was sleepy or not. Well, you know, that's one part of it, but there's also this other part, which is, yes, but how kind were you? How many cups of tea did you make? So Shantideva does not have the language of look at my attainment. Look at my attainment, hey, you monks, trying to laugh at me, but look, I've got the bodhicitta. You know, he's not about that. He's not saying, look how good I am. You get the sense of something in Shantideva that's far more vast, far more subtle, and that you become a part of the bodhicitta rather than the bodhicitta becoming part of you. And this is a very important point that Sangharakshita pulls out. He says that the bodhicitta is not a personal attainment, but a transpersonal experience. In fact, we have no words for it. And interestingly enough, and I don't know of any other Buddhist teacher who says this, but he says that it's more likely to arise in a collective situation than alone. He says, if you possess the bodhicitta, it isn't the bodhicitta. You've got hold of something else. It is the bodhicitta that possesses individual. So it's the bodhicitta that possesses you. So it's not a vision of existence where, you know, you get this attainment and then you become a kind of cosmic social worker. It's the kind of state where the distinctions between self and other collapses entirely, and what is left is total energy for the good of all. It's a transpersonal experience. It's something that is very, very hard to describe because it's not about you. It's not about the individual. And it's more likely, we're more likely to gain the bodhicitta together than alone. It's not something we can attain individually. It's more like it arises in a collective. So the bodhicitta is love. The bodhicitta arises in the collective. And the bodhicitta is also just plain goodness. Bodhicitta is a force for good in the world. There's a very lovely metaphor that Shantideva uses, where he talks about, he uses the bodhicitta as a metaphor, he uses the metaphor for lightning on a dark night. So what he's saying is that ordinary goodness is like a lightning flash that lights up a dark night, whereas the bodhicitta is much more powerful. The bodhicitta will conquer darkness entirely. So you have two images here. You have the darkness and you have the light. And the darkness, I think, is important because it shows you, it's good to be aware of just how close we are to really awful animal behaviour. Just how bad human behaviour can really be if we don't practice, if we don't make an effort. Look at somewhere like Bosnia, look at somewhere like Nazi Germany or Nazi Austria, look at somewhere like Rwanda. You could have people living peacefully side by side for many, many years, for even many generations. And then something will happen in certain conditions and people will denounce their own neighbour. They'll take over their neighbour's homes. They'll even murder them because they have a different race or religion. You don't have to look far to see the real lowest of human behaviour. And unfortunately, we're also capable of that given certain conditions. So it's quite a sobering thought what could happen to us if we don't practice. That's the real darkness, and the darkness exists. Just as we have potential to be Buddhas, we also have the potential to be a mass murderer. But within that darkness, within that potential for real awfulness, there is also the potential for light. So even in ordinary life, it's like lightning flashing up, flashing in darkness. At the same time as darkness, people do amazingly altruistic things. People in this Buddhist center do amazingly altruistic things. People here, you know, are nurses, doctors, social workers, teachers, parents. You know, they can really devote their lives to other people, to doing good for other people. But the bodhicitta is even more than that, and this is the point of Shantideva. The bodhicitta is unconditioned goodness. Because in ordinary goodness, we can swing back and forth. There's always a conflict between self and other. We can go so far to help others, but at the end of the day, actually, you know, after a while, you get a bit tired. You maybe even get a bit burnt out, and you need to rest. You need to take care of yourself for a while. And that's fair enough. That's what we do as human beings. Go back and forth. But in the bodhicitta, there's no conflict between self and other. And the bodhicitta is an irreversible, constant, unremitting goodness. It's so good that it's not even conscious of being good, of doing good. The bodhisattva, the being in whom the bodhicitta has arisen, doesn't think about, you know, well, I'm just going to do good for others. It's not like that. It's called the play of the bodhisattvas. They just have an infinite amount of energy just to put into the world. That conflict is entirely gone. The conflict between self and other is entirely gone. Not because you kind of become a cosmic martyr or something like that, but because actually the distinction between self and other is gone. The light has completely conquered the darkness. So the question is, well, how is that possible? And it's possible because the bodhicitta is love, but it's also wisdom. The bodhicitta is sometimes called shunyata karanagarbha, the essence of wisdom, compassion. And it's all one word. There's no distinction between this compassion and this wisdom. The bodhicitta is both those things at the same time. One arises out of the other. And this compassion, the compassion of the bodhisattva and of the bodhicitta, comes out of wisdom, comes out of the vision that sees all beings as unfixed, sees all beings are in a constant process of change, and that all beings are inseparable, interconnected, always affecting each other. So if one sees that others can really change, and that you can really affect another person, really do them good by who you are and how you behave, how could you not spend every moment dedicated and devoted to the transformation and the liberation of others? You have this vision of what the potential of humanity is. You have a vision that all beings can gain that potential. You have a vision that all beings are changing all the time, that they don't have to be fixed by past conditioning factors. And you see that you can influence them, that they're not isolated from you, you are not isolated from them, they're not isolated from the best of all beings. How could you not want to devote your whole life to making their liberation possible? If you've really seen that potential for liberation, how could you not want to make it possible? So the Bodhicaryavatara calls the bodhicitta a brilliant sun that dispels the mist of ignorance from the world. And the bodhicitta is that sun. It's the sun that burns off the ignorance of separate selfhood, that burns away self-preoccupation, the conflict between self and other, with light and warmth, comparable to the light and warmth of the sun. And that wisdom entails an overflowing, a bursting forth of love. There's this wonderful note, actually, in Thurman's translation of the Vimalakirti Nidesha, where he talks about the bodhicitta's love is not merely commiseration, but a spontaneous overflow of this great joy and relief in realizing the radiant nature of reality. So that's what happens in insight and into wisdom. You realize the radiant nature of reality and it bursts forth. It overflows in the great joy and relief, and wanting others to have that great joy and relief also. So the bodhicitta is love, it's goodness, it's the merging of love with wisdom, the merging of wisdom and compassion. And it's also mystery, it's also a very mysterious thing. So I'm going to give you a simile that's not going to sound very mysterious, I realised as I wrote it. I find it very mysterious, but that's because I'm not very scientific. Anyway. It says that the bodhicitta is the fresh butter risen up from churning the milk of the true Dharma. So what happens is that dependent on the milk and churning the milk, something of a completely different order arises. And Bhante makes this point about the bodhicitta. He says that the bodhicitta is the emergence within our ordinary experience of something of a totally different nature. And maybe we can get a taste of that. Maybe we can get a taste of that. I'm dependent on, you know, putting a bit of effort in here. What happens is you get over and above what you put in. So going back to the weekend retreat that some of us have gone on, well, in a way, you know, you just turn up.
That's the first thing you do. You eat a lot of very nice food that Sally and Sophie very generously cooked. You have a bit of seconds. And then you do a bit of meditation. Maybe you're a bit sleepy in the meditation. Maybe you're okay. You listen to a talk. You have discussion groups. You do a bit of a puja. You go for a walk with some friends. Eat a bit more. Have some more tea. Sleep pretty badly. Do the whole thing the next day. And then what you find at the end of the weekend is something extraordinary has happened. That's what I find. I've been doing these retreats, you know, for 13 years. And I find without fail, something over and above what I put in happens to me. Something actually amazing happens within my consciousness. It's not amazing in the sense of a completely wow cosmic vision or anything like that. But I definitely feel more positive, clearer. I never regret going on those weekend retreats. Something happens over and above what I put in. And I think that's pretty consistent for everyone who goes on weekend retreats. Put in a bit of effort, churn the milk of the Dharma, and out comes some butter. So the Bodhicharyavatara's mystery, it's also the mystery of transformation. There's another passage in the Bodhicharyavatara where he talks about taking this base image, the bodhicitta transmutes it into the priceless image of the Buddha jewel. Grasp tightly the quicksilver elixir known as the awakening mind, the bodhicitta, which must be thoroughly worked. So the bodhicitta transforms the base human form into the form of the Buddha. And to describe that, the Bodhicharyavatara uses this alchemical symbolism, which I find really exciting and really mysterious. You know, you can imagine that we're not just meditating in Sheffield Buddhist Centre, but secretly in our meditation what we're doing is we're staring over sort of funny coloured cauldrons and little test tubes of bubbling liquid or something. And it says, well, what you can do in that spiritual practice with the bodhicitta, when the bodhicitta arises, it transforms something, you know, quite base. You know, we have our moments of skillfulness, we have our moments of unskillfulness. But it transforms that ordinary human being, that ordinary human form, into the form of a Buddha. It's saying that we are the raw material that the bodhicitta transmutes into something of extraordinary value. And it uses the image of quicksilver. So quicksilver is mercury. It's very elusive. It's very magical. And the Bodhicharyavatara says, well, grasp tightly the quicksilver elixir. Well, I don't know if anyone's tried to grasp tightly mercury, but it's impossible. Mercury would just slip through your fingers. So the bodhicitta is a bit like that. It's not something you can grasp. It's not something solidly existing that you could hold tightly into your hands. It's something of a very elusive beauty. I remember my parents describing to me a palace in southern Spain that had pools of mercury in the courtyard. Doesn't have them now. They didn't see the pools of mercury. They just said in ancient times, this palace had pools of mercury. And for some reason, this image really stuck with me, the idea of having pools of mercury in a palace, apart from it being incredibly dangerous. There is something very magical, very precious about that image. So this is the radical vision of the Dharma. It doesn't matter where you start, anyone can transform. And according to Shantideva, it's this other-regarding attitude, it's this longing for the benefit of all beings that transforms this base human form into the form of the Buddha. There's a poem by Rumi in which he uses the same alchemical symbolism. He says, from love, bitter things become sweet. From love, copper becomes golden. From love, the dregs become pure. From love, pains become medicine. From love, the dead are made alive. So this is what the bodhicitta is. It's an alchemical quicksilver. It's the philosopher's stone that transforms us into the Buddha. But we have to work. The bodhicitta must be thoroughly worked. We have to live a life committed to deepening awareness and compassion. You can't buy the bodhicitta off a shelf.
What you have to do is put in the commitment, the dedication to the bodhicitta. You have to work the quicksilver. And that effort, that transformation is power. The bodhicitta is compared to a raging fire, to the raging fire that consumes the world at the end of an era. So what it's saying is you can really, really transform, but it will involve spiritual death. It will require a complete revolution in your being. Nothing will be left untouched. The raging fire. It's quite a challenging, quite a wrathful even image. You know, there's an image of bodhicitta which is beautiful. It's love, it's gentleness, it's desire for the well-being of others. But another image which is fire, the fire of transformation. It reminds me of a quote from Oscar Wilde's Fairy Stories, where he talks about love. And he says, "For love is wiser than philosophy, though he is wise, and mightier than power, though he is mighty. Flame-coloured are his wings, and coloured like flame is his body." Love will leave nothing untouched. And the good side of that is that all those old habits that you identify yourself with, all those past conditionings, are completely transformed. But what is left? What are you without your old conditioning habits? Who are you? You become a force. You become that fire. And there's something in the fire. Well, there's nothing solid in fire itself. Fire is pure change, pure power, pure force. But it's not destruction. Because in the Bodhicaryavatara, he talks about becoming a child of the Buddha. He invokes a kind of Buddha pride. You become this fire, but you're not nothing. You are a child of the Buddha. He says, "Today I am born into the family of the Buddha. Now I am the Buddha's son. So that there may be no blemish upon this spotless family, I must now act as becomes my family." You become the Buddha's son and you get incredible pride, but the pride of the Buddha, not the pride of the self, not the pride of conceit of what I can do rather than as opposed to what you can do. The real pride of being linked to the best in the world. And you know, we all have a piece of that. To the extent that you practice the spiritual life, to that extent you have the pride of acting for the best in the world. It's an incredible thing that we all do and should never be lost sight of. But the main thing, in a way, is that the bodhicitta is a response to suffering. And the bodhicitta is about freedom from suffering. Shantideva says, "You who are accustomed to travelling abroad among the trading towns of the realms of rebirth, grasp tightly this jewel that is the bodhicitta. It is precious, assayed by those of immeasurable expertise, the unique caravan leaders of the world." So it has this image of living beings passing through a trading town. We blunder around going over the same old habits, and it's exhausting. There's a part in the Dhammapada where the Buddha says, "Difficult is the attainment of the human state. Difficult is the life of mortals. Difficult is the hearing of the real truth. Difficult is the appearance of the enlightened ones." This human life is hard, and we don't know how long we've been doing it. I'll shorten this a bit. I realise I'm running out of time, but anyway. The Buddha also says, "Which do you think is more, the flood of tears which weeping and wailing you have shed upon this long way, hurrying and hastening through the rounds of rebirths, uniting with the undesired, separated from the desired, this or the waters of the four oceans? Long time have you suffered the death of father and mother, of sons, daughters, brothers and sisters. And whilst you were thus suffering, you have indeed shed more tears upon this long way than there is water in the four oceans. And thus have you long time undergone suffering, undergone torment, undergone misfortune, and filled the graveyards full. Truly, long enough to be dissatisfied with all the forms of existence, long enough to turn away and free yourselves from them all." So the bodhicitta is a vision of human existence, both in terms of potential and in terms of the great suffering, the great exhaustion that we have in this world, wandering endlessly around the same old habits, doing the same old things. And we don't know how long we've been doing that. But the bodhicitta is a jewel in this vision of existence, because it represents living with purpose and meaning and beauty and preciousness in the midst of ever-changing reality. The image of the bodhicitta as the most precious gen. The bodhicitta is also compared to the elixir of life, born to end death in the world. So elixir is another word for amrita, the nectar or ambrosia of life, the life-giving medicine. And obviously the bodhicitta doesn't mean that you're going to live forever. But what is eternal life? Well, eternal life is eternal meaning. Eternal life is when you transcend life and death altogether. So the bodhicitta sees the sorrow in the world. It sees the absolute devastation of loss. And what it does is it doesn't end death. It doesn't end what reality can be like. But it makes you lose the fear of death. It makes you all right whatever happens. You know, you can't save others from death. You can't save yourself from death. You can't save the people you love from death. But you can save people from the fear of death. And that's what the bodhicitta does. It saves people from the fear of death because it gives you a much greater meaning. It gives you the meaning of universal redemption. That's what your life becomes about. And so one little life in a big vision of universal redemption, universal liberation, isn't so important anymore. It's sort of been on my mind for a while today, particularly because some of you might know, my brother's wife had a miscarriage at 6 months, and they've just had the funeral for their baby today. And hearing a grown man cry about the loss of his child is a terrible thing. It's a terrible thing to hear your brother cry because he's lost a child. And it's even more terrible for my mother, because she said to me, we were walking along, she said to me, you know, it's worse, you feel your children's pain more than you feel your own. And at that point I looked at my mum and I said, well, listen, mum, you know you never have to worry about me. You know you never, whatever happens, you never have to worry about me. And she said to me, you know I never have to worry about you. And she really meant that, and I thought that was very, very interesting, because on the surface of things, I haven't got any money, I've got no security, I've got no pension prospects, I don't even have security of tenure where I live. In a way, materially, I've got nothing, but even my mother, who's not even a Buddhist, would know that whatever happens, I'll be all right. Whatever happens, I'll be all right, because I have meaning in my life. So the bodhicitta is compared to an inexhaustible treasure alleviating poverty in the world. The poverty of an empty life. It's not going to give you loads of money all of a sudden. But it's going to relieve that frustration of existence, that poverty existence, of existence where you wake up in the morning and you don't know what your life is about. And you don't know what you're doing. And you don't know what you're here for. You know, we talk a lot about relieving literal poverty, but there's another poverty. There's a poverty and frustration of spirit. And this is what the bodhicitta relieves. It relieves it because you always feel connected. You always feel meaning in your life. You always have a vision of existence that's beyond the self, that's beyond just you. It's beyond even your own liberation. It's about the liberation of others, which is a far richer and greater vision. As Bodhi Shantideva says, he says, well, may every direction be a place of delight, with gardens of magical trees that grant every wish, teeming with Buddhas and the heirs of the Buddhas, enthralling with the sound of the Dharma. Well, that's what our life becomes like with the bodhicitta. Everything sings the song of the Dharma. Everything has meaning. Everything has richness. Everything has the potential to Buddhahood. Oh my gosh. So I'll just end it, I think.
I could go on. You see what it's like. You could just go on and on and on. There's so many images about the bodhicitta. But I won't bore you because you're all freezing to death. The bodhicitta is the eternal warmth. The eternal warmth of liberation. So Bodhicharya-vatara is primarily about the cultivation of the bodhicitta, the mysterious force of love, goodness, wisdom, transformation, power, and the end of suffering. And it's not just an idea, it's not just an obscure Buddhist teaching, but it's real. It's an ever-present reality for us as practitioners. And we can be part of it. Maybe we are part of it already. Because in some ways we can think about the bodhicitta as this big kind of cosmic experience that's a million miles down the line. But maybe we're aligning ourselves with the bodhicitta every time we do something for the benefit of someone else. Every time we align ourselves with that love, with that goodness, with that wisdom, with that transformation. Every day when we transform a little bit more of ourselves into love and compassion and wisdom, then maybe, just as a blind man might find a jewel in heaps of rubbish, so too this bodhicitta will somehow appear in me. We can do it. We can do it in the collective experience of Sheffield Buddhist Centre. And I really believe that. If I didn't believe that, I really wouldn't be here. So what a thing to aspire to do. Let's gain the bodhicitta, not just for ourselves, but for everybody.